there are diminishing returns to marketing in within a service area around, you know, one of our physical locations or studio spaces or, you know, wherever we're choosing to operate. You know, the more we spend, we're acquiring a customer that's harder and harder to reach, right? Because we didn't find them the first time around. So by naturally, you know, the incremental customer is more expensive to acquire. And so it helps us to find, to know when we've hit that endpoint, to your point. And that's how you get to the optimal amount of marketing dollars.
Tim Topham here, and welcome back to the Topcast from Top Music Co. Have you ever wondered if your school might be valuable to someone in the future? If you wanted to leave, could you sell it? How would that actually work? How would it look? What would you need to do? These are the kinds of questions that we're going to be answering in today's episode. And our special guest today is Jeff Homer from Ensemble Music Schools. At Top Music, we love guiding and supporting teachers just like you to engage, motivate, and inspire your students and run the most sustainable studio business possible, using our integrated music teaching formula. No matter what instrument you teach, whether you teach online or in person, groups or individuals, and whether your students practice 2 hours a day or not at all, we are here to support and guide you, to give you confidence and help you feel a little bit less isolated in your studio each and every day. Our show notes for today's episode are over at topmusic.co/episode-299. My guest today, Jeff, founded Ensemble Music Schools in 2019 as a passion project that promised to combine his hobby as an amateur musician with his professional background in investing. Starting with just one school in Louisville, Colorado, Jeff's vision was to build a best-in-class administrative platform that would equip local community music schools to thrive in the digital age and better serve their students and teaching faculty. Motivated by some early successes and the blessing of doing what you love, Jeff left his day job to focus full-time on Ensemble in early 2020 and hasn't looked back. Jeff's prior employers include institutional investment firms Bain Capital, Reservoir Capital, and Independent Capital Asset Partners. Jeff graduated magna cum laude from Harvard University with a degree in economics. Welcome to the Topcast, Jeff. Great to meet you.
Tim, appreciate making the time for me to be here.
So for those of you who don't know you, you run a company called Ensemble Music Schools. Can you let us know a little bit about what it does?
So we hide the ball a little bit on purpose with Ensemble. So there are no Ensemble Music Schools that you can go visit. We are an owner and operator of local community-based music schools that all do business under their original branding. So we are an owner and operator of 37 as of today. Music schools across the United States, and they're all, you know, Tampa Music School, Dana V Music, Real Music Academy, sort of whatever they were when they were acquired by us. And our role has been to partner with outgoing owners of those businesses who, you know, poured blood, sweat, and tears into building those communities and, you know, really making them to be wonderful, you know, gathering places for teachers and students, and to basically help them facilitate a change they wanted to make in their life, whether that was retirement or spending more time with family or relocation or other business interests. And we've been entrusted to continue to operate those businesses and to fill and realize those visions for those music communities.
Mm. And do you find most of the schools which you take over are for the owners retiring, or are they sometimes so generally older, or are they sometimes younger and just want to do something different?
Yeah, we've had a mix. I would say maybe 2/3 have been retirements. It's definitely the most common, but especially, you know, young parents has been another one, you know, parents with young kids that want to spend time with those kids. Another is just sort of, I think a lot of music school owners get into the business as teachers and get away from the day-to-day practice of teaching by becoming a music school administrator. And I think we've had really successful partnerships with owners that wanted to return to the classroom and return to their identity as teachers and not be a manager of a school anymore. And so in some really fun cases, they've actually stayed on after we've acquired the school as a teacher. So
I was going to ask if that happened. Yeah,
definitely. We have 4 or 5 of those examples, and they've been really fun where, you know, the owner is still involved and everyone still assumes they own the school, but we're doing all the work in the background and letting them take the credit. It's sort of a fun relationship.
That's cool. I'm interested to unpack a little bit about that work that you do in the background. But what about yourself? How did you get into this? I know you've been a lifelong musician, at least. How did you end up with this? Because it's quite a niche business.
Yeah, it's an unusual story. I've been a lifelong student of music. I took 10 years of piano lessons growing up. I like to say today that I played a high school level still, nothing. I will neither embarrass myself nor dazzle anyone at the piano. I was in my high school and college choirs, and I took a few years of drum lessons when I was living in New York City. So I've really enjoyed the journey of exploration in music, and the many guides I've had along that journey has been really fun. My professional background's in investing. So I was a Harvard undergrad in economics. Out of school, I did the American East Coast, sort of Wall Street investing thing. In that capacity, I worked with lots of small and medium-sized businesses to sort of help them develop infrastructure for growth. So oftentimes what you see with a fast-growing small or medium-sized business is a really good idea or product at the center and not a lot of business infrastructure that needs to be built around it. And in 2018, I moved from New York to Denver, and I massively upgraded my quality of life, not only by, having a lot more outdoors, available to me, but by going from working, New York hours, which is to say all of them, to working more traditional, sort of family office hours. And with my spare time and apparently my lack of hobbies, I felt like I wanted some kind of side project. And so I went looking for a community-based small business that I could acquire. I wanted to something I could work on in my, evenings and weekends, something that would offer me a way to sort of see a tangible impact on the community that wasn't just sort of moving figures around in Excel spreadsheets. And I had the very good fortune, pretty much by accident, to be introduced to a woman who was selling a music school. And I walked into this building, and I think this would be true for many of your listeners. This was just a really positive space. You walk in the door, it's empty, right? There's nobody there. There's no kid. Like, it's a totally different place with kids and teachers and energy. But even empty, it just felt warmer than any place I'd been in years in the finance world. And it was a place I just felt like I wanted to spend some time. And as I got to know sort of the business a little bit better, it was clear that it had been started, from a love of music pedagogy and teaching, and it was built around a really outstanding student experience. But it was built without some of those business, best practices that I mentioned, sort of being responsible for building at lots of growing businesses. And so I just felt like there was an opportunity for me to help. I can't add any value in the classroom, but I can definitely, get behind the scenes and work hard on, operations and marketing and finance and sales. And that was what we did. So I bought the first school. I can tell you about how that went, but it went well enough that we chose to do it 36 more times, trying to find wonderful schools like this to acquire. And it's been a really fun journey.
Wow. There's definitely the love, life, and passion of the music educator in all of the studios that the listeners are running around the place. I know exactly what you mean there. And that warmth and buzz and energy is all too real when you go into these buildings, when people have multiple teachers and things running. So I can see how that can be captivating for someone that's been on Wall Street and had a very, a vanilla financial experience like that.
My guess is many of our parents feel that when they walk into, right? I mean, they're obviously bringing their kids, but they're coming from sterile corporate environments. And like these
sterile,
are
that's better. That's into. A better word. Yeah. You mentioned one of the things you did with the investments on Wall Street, the SMEs that you were working with, the small to medium enterprises, was the business infrastructure. So they had great products or great ideas, but lacking the infrastructure. You said the same thing about music school. Music school owners are great at delivering great lessons and a great customer experience and looking after everyone, not so good at the infrastructure or the system. So what are those things that you find music school owners sometimes lack?
So the first and maybe most subtle but most important is sort of a mindset around thinking of the business as a business, right? And what I mean by that is, for the business to sustain itself and, all of the individuals that are part of its ecosystem, it has to make money. And that means thinking about what is the cost to acquire a customer, what is the lifetime value of that customer, and what is it cost to serve them over its life, right? And you need those two things to add up to less than the lifetime value of the customer. And that's a formula that's generic enough to apply to any industry. But it's not something that it's not a thought process that I I think if I asked people I'd acquired schools from, you know, what's the lifetime value of a student for you? I think they'd have a really hard time answering that question. And I think unpacking that can actually free up lots of opportunity for investing more in marketing, because there is a really high, this is a sticky, long-lived customer. Like, from an investor's perspective, the music school business is a great business, right? It's a recurring revenue business. It's a high customer lifetime value business where the student comes back, you know, over and over every week for years. That has the same dynamic as other, you know, favored business models for investors, like, you know, software as a service and other things like that have these sky high valuations. We have lots of the same characteristics in our business model. We just don't know how to talk about it in the same way. And I think starting from there is really important. Getting to a more tactical level, you know, once you've started to think in that way, you're trying to manage, you know, several things, right? So we've calculated our customer lifetime value. We're trying to find ways to increase it, right? So we're thinking about, you know, what causes churn in our business? You know, when do we observe students leaving, you know, like quitting lessons, and how do we attack that? Can we do it through convenience, through retention, through performance opportunities, through, you know, just changing things up through the year, like, you know, sort of thought processes like that. We can start to track our customer acquisition costs, right? We can track our marketing investment and our return on that marketing spend and come up with a customer acquisition cost number. And we can use that to try to improve our marketing spend over time and, you know, do little A/B testing and, you know, drive that down, or even use it to determine what our marketing budget should be, right? I think a lot of people set arbitrary marketing budgets of, well, I can afford $500, I can afford $1,000, and that's the inverse way of setting a marketing budget correctly. And then again, just sort of the moving to the last bucket of, like, what's the cost to serve the customer over time? You know, I think most of your listeners are teachers and strong believers in teachers, right? And so they're going to value that teacher's experience, and, you know, we're all going to want to pay our teachers as well as possible. Which means being really efficient on the admin side is how we're going to lower our cost to serve the client over the life of the customer, right? So that means that we have to be really efficient with systematization and automation and using software where possible, and just, you know, leveraging every opportunity to make the experience both higher quality for the family and for the student, but also, you know, lower cost to serve for the business. And that's, you know, those are ultimately the directions we need to drive in.
That's easy. All easy and done. Great. No, I mean, that's you've covered an absolute ton of stuff there. So let's just unpack a few things, because I know customer acquisition costs, lifetime value, these are words that many listeners won't have heard perhaps before. So my understanding, lifetime value is the value of one student over the standard lifetime that they will be with you. So let's say, and you have to work this out, right? How long does a student normally stay with you? So let's say that's 10 years. If you're doing really well, that's a great amount of time. And every year they're bringing in $1,000 for you. So your customer lifetime value is 10,000 times 1,000, right?
Yeah, 10 years times 1,000 a year. Yeah, that'd be $10,000. Yeah.
So that's customer lifetime value. And knowing that allows you to work out, well, how much can you afford to spend to acquire them? So that's customer acquisition cost. So officially, if you spend anything less than 10,000, or whatever it was, to acquire them, you still will be making money. But obviously, there's a lot of other costs to consider. What percentage do you work on a percentage customer acquisition cost compared to lifetime value?
It's typical in the industry to think of a ratio. So you would measure, you know, for every dollar I spend in marketing, how many dollars of revenue or gross profit do I expect to make, right? So there's we're now getting, you know, to a very granular level, but there's some people talk about lifetime value in terms of revenue, and some people talk about lifetime value in terms of gross profit. Both are fair ways of thinking about it. It's important to know which one you're talking about, because they're different by half, right? But it's typical, a common way to think about is, you know, for every dollar of marketing that I deploy, I expect to get, you know, $7, $10, $12 in lifetime value from a customer. And that can be a light bulb moment in terms of being willing to invest more in marketing. When you say, hey, how many other opportunities do you have in your life to, you know, invest $1 and get $10 back over a reasonable period of time? And, you know, you as the business owner own this magic machine that can convert, you know, dollars into $10 bills, and we should maybe run some more dollars through that machine.
Hello, this is Lila Viss, longtime friend and fan of Tim, his podcast, and his top music community. I'm pleased to support his groundbreaking efforts. Key Ideas is my podcast, and when you get finished with Tim's latest episode, I invite you to tune into Key Ideas. It's filled with illuminating interviews and transparent reflections. Besides podcasting, I enjoy encouraging musicians to get creative beyond the page and jumpstart their composing skills. Are you interested in nurturing budding composers too, but aren't sure where to begin? If so, it's time to sign up for my 8+8 Composium. It's a 4-week online course and limited to 8 teachers. Within just a few short weeks, you'll design your own composition 8 bars at a time and take away tons of strategies to help your students do the same. Head to lilaviss.com, use discount coupon code TOP10, and save on registration. I look forward to meeting you and your creativity.
Right. And conversely, if you're spending $1 and getting 50 cents back, then you don't want to be running more bills through that machine.
And that's the natural governor, right? Because there are diminishing returns to marketing within a service area around, you know, one of our physical locations or studio spaces or, you know, wherever we're choosing to operate. You know, the more we spend, we're acquiring a customer that's harder and harder to reach, right? Because we didn't find them the first time around. So by naturally, you know, the incremental customer is more expensive to acquire. And so it helps us to know when we've hit that endpoint, to your point. And that's how you get to the optimal amount of marketing dollars.
Hopefully everyone hasn't tuned out, because I actually quite like this, because even running my own business, I have to think about these very figures too. So it's great to hear someone like you who comes into music schools and assesses them and works out the best ways to optimize them. I think it's important for music teachers to hear this, that yes, we're all running businesses, and it doesn't matter if you've got 2 students or 100, you need to be thinking about these figures if you want to make sure that you are profitable. And it's great to know, Jeff, that music schools can be profitable. You are proving that this is the case, right?
Yeah, and you know, fantastically profitable in some cases. I mean, you know, we've been proud to acquire, you know, some family-based local businesses for, you know, a couple million dollars, right? So people are walking away with significant sums of money at the end of their career. And yeah, so and not in a way that sacrificed, you know, the reputation in the community, the student experience, the teacher experience. You know, they were doing right by everyone in their community. And it was just by, you know, doing that at scale that they were able to, you know, achieve, you know, meaningful wealth for themselves. Yeah.
Now, this may be too big a question to answer, but I was going to say, how do you put a value on the schools that you assess? Is there a simple kind of formula you use, or is it very varied?
There's a relatively established market for all small businesses, basically. So, you know, lots of our studios are in, you know, strip centers or, you know, other kind of similar retail footprint. And our neighbors, the restaurant, the pizza shop, the tutoring business, they all trade hands from time to time. And we can look at that to determine what the sort of market valuation for this sort of thing is. And at the end of the day, it's typically between 2.5 and 3.5 times what's referred to as seller's discretionary earnings. And what that is basically the money that goes to the owner of the business, whether it's through the profit or the money they pay themselves after sort of factoring in their replacement costs. So after you figure out how much it would cost to replace their teaching time and their admin time, you know, any salary they're paying themselves above that amount, any distributions they're taking from the business, that's seller discretionary earnings. And you're generally going to get about 2.5 to 3.5 times that number is a reasonable expectation to have for valuation.
Okay, that's great. I really appreciate you sharing that. So as a simple calculation, let's say you generally take home $100,000. When you sell the business, you're going to need to hire someone to replace you. Let's say they're going to cost $50,000. So your seller discretionary earnings is $50,000. That's $100,000 minus $50,000. And then you apply a multiple to that of 2 or 3%-ish.
Two or three times.
2.5 to 3.5 Yeah. So that type of business would generally get, you know, $125,000 to $175,000 on the open market. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Oh, that'll be a useful little calculation. I can see everyone's probably listening to this now going, oh, I wonder what my school, what do I earn? And then you have to make sure that you can actually prove all these earnings and things, which is another reason why it's important to have bookkeepers and not shoeboxes full of receipts. And everybody, make sure you have your own business account separate to your personal account and things like that. I mean, there must be times when you get approached by businesses and you just go, where do I even start? This is so intertwined with their personal finances. Can you give us some tips of those mistakes that schools who want to sell are making?
Yeah, I mean, I won't name any names here, of course, but I've been told straight up that, you know, we're taking money under the table. You can't find it on our P&L, but like, you know, you have to give us credit for extra revenue. I've just said, you know, no, you know, and you're lucky I'm not calling the IRS.
Put it all on the books.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, so it's relatively standard practice, you know, for folks to, you know, run things like their personal automobile, you know, through the business and, you know, a limited amount of personal travel, that sort of thing. These are relatively standard things that are easily identifiable and easy to take out. But, you know, when you go beyond that to buying your groceries on the business credit card, it doesn't matter if you come after the fact and say, you know, I had all these personal expenses. It's really difficult to substantiate that. And so you'll do much better to, you know, just to your point, have clean books, you know, you'll get a better valuation. You'll gain more in valuation than you lose in taxation from running clean and separate books and records.
And I always encourage teachers to have bookkeepers. Would you do this? I mean, it doesn't really matter how few students you have, just to have proper books that are up to date and not done by you, I think is a good investment. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. And I mean, you know, the cost of that starts at a few hundred dollars a year, you know, for your local CPA that, you know, is going to spend a few hours to, you know, to do your books. It's really an approachable investment.
So I'm keen to know, you must walk in some cases a bit of a fine line between making schools, ensuring they're profitable, and they need to be profitable enough that not only is everyone getting paid, but your company can make a profit too, without compromising the integrity of the musical experience too. So how do you walk that line?
Sure. It's a great question. And I think the fun part is that the answer leads to a really positive place. So I don't have anything to do with what happens in the lesson room, right? So our philosophy from a pedagogical perspective is that music is a very individualized journey, and that each student deserves a teacher that's a great fit for them and who's going to provide kind of a customized or personalized path through their you know, journey of learning and discovery. I'm certainly not qualified to show up at a teacher's door and tell them they're doing that wrong. And so, you know, the lesson room is sort of sacred in our model, where nothing we're doing on the business side affects the student experience. Additionally, the music school business has a feature that investors refer to as operating leverage, which means that there are a relatively high number of costs that are fixed in the business, right? Once you've paid for your studio space, you paid for your front desk staff, you know, those things are generally, to a first approximation, those things are fixed. Obviously, if you triple the number of students, you need more space, you need more staff. But to, you know, from today to tomorrow, those costs are fixed. And that means that we have an opportunity to scale that expense or leverage that expense against a greater amount of revenue. And so for us, increased profitability comes from growing our community and signing up more students. And so that's always a really positive direction to be heading in, because it means more work for our teachers, more students at our performances, more kids to throw together into ensembles and chamber opportunities. Like, it's just a really positive thing for the communities, where our success and our profitability will come from putting the maximum number of students through the physical infrastructure that we have to serve them.
Without having to increase the fixed costs.
Correct.
Yeah. So you're kind of maximizing the value you can get out of the costs that are already in the business.
Right. And you know, things that go into that are like lengthening the teaching day, right? So, you know, making sure that our teachers can teach, you know, from noon to 8 instead of from 3 p.m. to 8 p.m., which again utilizes the physical space better and makes it more attractive to the teacher to be there for the full day and, you know, not have to have a part-time job in the morning or something else like that. So I think that, you know, our goals as a business are very aligned with the goals of our stakeholders in terms of teachers and students. And so I feel really good about that. I don't think that there's much compromise on that front.
What have you been finding is successful with for student new student acquisition? Because obviously that's one of the key things you're saying you do when you come in. Obviously, yes, you're fixing or taking on marketing, trying to reduce overspend on admin, and you're trying to find more students if the capacity is there. Have you got a couple of ways, without giving away all your secrets, Jeff, of course, that other music studio owners who are listening can try or learn from?
Sure. So most of our work comes down to what I think has been referred to as sort of the Google Big Three, right? So you need to be doing Google My Business, Google Search, and Google Ads, right? So spending money on paid marketing on Google. Those are your big three. I think there was it was not that long ago that Facebook was an important part of that conversation. I think post the changes that have been made to the iPhone software that have prevented ad targeting, Facebook's ad targeting performance has dropped incredibly far to the point where it's almost not worth talking about anymore. So we think about, having an accurate, up-to-date, high-quality Google My Business profile that has reviews, that has photos, that has posts from the business. Those all cost nothing, right? They're really easy opportunities to make sure that Google prioritizes you by looking at your Google My Business profile and making sure that it's built out and that it has nice content and that, you're inviting your community to say nice things about you. That's going to be a factor for your organic rankings on Google, as is your website, and making sure that you're, talking about what you do, using kind of, there's lots that's been written about kind of basic SEO, search engine optimization practice. You can hire somebody to do that, for, it's usually included in any kind of, sort of small business website build price. So it's, that's a relatively straightforward thing to get. Obviously, we have much more sophisticated, approaches to that, but the easy steps are out there for everybody. And then the last piece is our media spend on Google, which we find to have a very good return where, we're searching for people that are searching for piano lessons near me, and we're trying to serve ads to them because it's the highest intent customer you can find, right? It's a mom or dad or young adult who is literally looking for music lessons and doesn't have a place in mind, right? And so going back to our conversation about what that client is worth, in our estimation, they're worth $1,500 to $1,800 and it costs $3 to $4 a click, to be in front of them. And if we think our website is good and our copy will generate, conversions, meaning, signups or inquiries, we're coming out so far ahead on, that cost of that $3 to $4 click versus the lifetime value of a $1,800 student.
Really great way to think about it. And I like that reference to the top three. Go back and re-listen to it if you're interested in ways to market that works for someone like Jeff and all of his 37 schools. I'm also interested to know about teachers because there is a bit of a dearth of teachers, it seems, at the moment, or definitely quality teachers. Are you finding the same challenge? And I should ask one more question. Do you leave the hiring of teachers to the teams at the school, or do you help with that?
Sure. So, Ensemble has a team of really wonderful recruiting staff that works in partnership with the location managers. So this is typical of our relationship with our schools is we ask our school managers to be responsible for the people that walk through their door, right? So students, parents, teachers, great customer service, that in-person experience, that's what we ask of our school level staff. Everything else we handle at the Ensemble level in a centralized way. That's kind of part of our value proposition. And one of those services we offer to the schools is a team of recruiters who are their teachers. They're all teachers by background, and they are sourcing and helping to evaluate prospective candidates for pedagogy, and then the location manager is evaluating them for local fit, right? And so it's sort of a two thumbs up approach to hiring. They have to be a fit on the recruiter side and then on the location manager side. I think we went through a really it's an obvious understatement to say that we went through a very unusual period economically in the last 3 years. And I think, many music teachers had to reconsider, many musicians had to reconsider their careers because performance opportunities weren't available. And I think a lot of people exited the industry and took, you know, they took, you know, they took day jobs, right? They took generic corporate jobs because they were available, especially, you know, especially during the really tight, you know, hiring market we've had in the last year and a half or so. So I do think that there are people that used to be musicians that are now software developers and, you know, whatever, you know, sorts of things that they may have picked up during the pandemic. I think, you know, for us as Ensemble, we care a lot about teacher retention. It's one of the most important drivers of student retention, being a place where a teacher can come, stay for a long time, you know, feel valued and have that feel like it's a career and they're being treated comparably to advanced degreed professionals in other professions, right? I mean, you know, there are very few, you know, industries in which people are expected to be treated worse than, you know, people with EMA, right? Like if you have a doctorate in anything else, you get, you know, the red carpet is rolled out for you. So we're trying really hard to do that. I mean, we're trying right now to make sure that we're paying competitively and adjusting our pay rates aggressively in the face of cost of living inflation. We're offering things like 401ks and health benefits to, you know, to our teachers that meet certain criteria in terms of hours worked. And, you know, most importantly, and I don't think this is different, this is nothing different than any of your listeners are doing, but just making sure that we're making their lives easy at the school, right? So recognizing that every studio teacher has the option of teaching out of their living room if they don't feel that they're being well served in the studio environment, you know, we need to make sure that we are providing our half of the bargain in terms of giving them a really full schedule, handling that administrative load, making sure that we're finding them students that are a fit for them, you know, musically. That's, you know, that's what we hope is kind of our, you know, is our value proposition to that, you know, to that teacher. And, you know, it is competitive. And if we don't do a good job of it, they will leave to other schools or other industries. And so it's, you know, it's been a thought, it's been something on the top of my mind for a while. It's very different by geography. I can tell you there are parts of the United States where we do not struggle to hire teachers at all. And there are other parts where, you know, we really work to find quality candidates. But you know, that will come in waves, but, you know, our goal will always be to be a attractive long-term destination for our teachers.
Well, I'm going to wrap things up with just a couple more questions, if that's all right. I know there's probably going to be some people listening thinking, well, maybe I could sell my studio in a few years' time. So what advice would you give them? What should they be doing now to start planning for that possibility in the future?
Sure. So it's a great question. I think the number one thing is trying to find ways to distance themselves from the day-to-day operations, right? So if you are a school owner who is the absolute lifeblood of your school studio, whether it's you're working the desk 50 hours a week, you're teaching 50 students a week, you know, just if the business is really personally tied to you, it's going to be very hard to sell the business and for you to walk away without a lot of risk and discontinuity and just it'll be a disruptive time for your school. And so starting to back away is a way to prepare your business for sale, prepare yourself mentally for walking away from the business, and find out whether you actually, you know, want to be, you know, selling the business. And, you know, maybe you'll find that the spare time, you know, invested in other hobbies or, you know, with grandkids or other things is really wonderful. And maybe you'll find that it is not, and you decide to change your mind. But, you know, making sure that the business is actually a saleable asset that can be separated from your person is, you know, an important first step. So that means, you know, starting to teach fewer students and transition students to other teachers, starting to have front desk staff that are more visible to the clientele. And, you know, you're not taking as many parent phone calls with people trying to go over their head, you know, having days where you don't go into the studio just because, and, you know, starting to back away and making sure that your systems and processes are really good to where, you know, you can, and, you know, there's lots of side benefits to that, right? You can actually go on vacation and not answer the phone. And like, there's lots of reasons you should want your studio to run that way. You know, selling it is only one of them. But yeah, I think that's, you know, that's probably the biggest piece of advice is start to make your business something that stands on its own without you, so that it can, you know, be your legacy after you've moved on.
Well, thanks for sharing all of that and being so open and helpful, Jeff. I've really appreciated the conversation. I know lots of people listening will have got a lot from that as well. Are you open to people contacting you if they're interested in talking? And if so, where can they find out more?
Yeah, we would love nothing more. So we are we're online at ensembleschools.com. I'm Jeff at ensembleschools.com. You can hit me up directly, or you know, visit our website, and there's lots of content there aimed at informing folks about who we are and what we do, and you can get in touch that way as well. But no, for facilitating transitions of ownership is, you know, is our business, and there's nothing that makes me happier than getting sort of inbound inquiries from folks that have heard of us. And it's starting to happen more and more, which is really fun.
That's great. And before we wrap up, is there anything I've kind of missed that you, as someone that does this day to day, thinks we should cover?
I just want to emphasize something I said at the beginning, which is, you know, I had a lifelong journey through music, and I think, you know, teaching is a really, it's a really wonderful profession in terms of the impact you're having on students. And, you know, I still think about my piano teacher a lot, and, you know, when I get my practice book up. So, yeah, coming from someone with a business background, I have immense respect for what happens inside the classroom, and just want to emphasize that, because we got pretty wonky into the finance side of things. I don't want anyone to think that I'm not coming at this from the right place. So it's something I have a ton of respect for.
Thanks for coming on the show, Jeff.
Yeah, I appreciate the time. It's awesome.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's interview and have had some questions answered. And make sure you follow up with any questions, and you can leave comments on our show notes page, topmusic.co/episode299, or contact Jeff if you're interested. Now, I can't believe it, but next week on the podcast, we hit 300 episodes. It doesn't seem that long ago, back in 2015, that I started with episode number one with the amazing Daniel McFarlane. Next week, we're going to unpack a little bit about how we got to 300 episodes, but we also have a massive new announcement that I cannot wait to share with you. More on that next week. Until then, I'll leave you waiting and wondering. I'm Tim Topham, and you've been listening to The Topcast. Thanks so much for joining us again. Whether it's your first or 300th, almost 299th episode, I'm so glad to have spent this time with you. Thank you very much for joining me, and I'll speak to you next week. For more information about this episode and to find out how to enhance your own teaching, visit topmusic.co. You'll find everything you need for your studio, from lesson plans to cheat sheets, quick win teaching ideas, and guides on how to build your teaching business. Plus, you'll be connected to a global community of the world's top music teachers. And when you're ready, join hundreds of other teachers around the world by becoming a Top Music Pro member and get access to all our bonus content and flagship courses. And don't forget to follow topmusic.co on social media and subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. That's all for today. We'll see you in the studio.